Imagine building homes for retirees in a pastoral rural area with picturesque views and quaint local history. Oh, and since the small rural town is in China, it consists of only 8 million people. That's the life of YPO member and developer Paul Tao of China, where there are more people than there is land. This is YPO 10-Minute Tips from the Top. I'm Kevin Daum, and each week I bring you insights from the world's top executives of YPO, all made possible with grants from Gazelle's Growth Institute, www.growthinstitute.com. YPO member Paul Tao has dominated the Asian real estate industry for more than 20 years. With degrees from the best universities such as the University of Cambridge, this erudite professional kicked off his career as a lawyer for McKenna & Company in London and Hong Kong. From there, he shifted into real estate sales in the Chinese city of Suzhou, taking on the role of assistant general manager at the Suzhou Garden Villa Development and Management Company. Paul soon joined the family business and became director of New Heritage Development Limited. Shortly after, he rose to serve as the managing director of New Heritage Holdings Limited, a publicly listed company on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange main board, specializing in real estate development and investment in mainland China. Today, Paul is the managing director of the family business New Heritage Investments Limited in Hong Kong. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kevin. Happy to be here.
So, Paul, you have been really at the window of China's development for decades. What year was it that your father started the real estate company?
He started the real estate company in 1991, which was fairly early on in China's opening up to the outside world.
That didn't work out so well at first, right?
No, he bounced around for quite a few years. So between 1985 and 1991 was quite a few years until he decided to really just risk everything. And he bought a piece of land in a city just outside of Shanghai called Suzhou. That was a city that was really quite undeveloped in an undeveloped country. He had a vision. He thought that he could create basically a lot of homes there for a lot of friends that he had in Hong Kong that would eventually reach retirement age like him and would like to live in a town which had a lot of history as a very picturesque town, and it used to be the Silk Capital of China.
China was just opening up to outside investment at that time, right? And there really wasn't a picture of Hong Kong becoming part of China in 91, correct?
Yes, no, China was just opening up, so a lot of services went there. There was no medical services that would be suitable for Hong Kong people. In fact, trying to build something in Suzhou was a challenge itself because it was so difficult to get to.
So what prompted you to come into the business?
Why I got into the business was in order to do a property development, you needed to have a lot of people join in. You can't do it on your own. My father was having a lot of difficulty hiring such professionals because people would work in the big cities, in Beijing, in Shanghai, in Guangzhou. But people wouldn't go out to a small town of 8 million people, Suzhou.
A small town of 8 million, okay.
That's right.
That would make Manhattan, New York, a mid-sized city, right?
That's right. So I eventually joined him. I was working as a lawyer at the time in Hong Kong. And I think he wasn't very happy that I would quit a well-paying job. But I think he was probably happy to have his sons join him.
Did you feel like pioneers in this environment? Did you have a strong feeling that China would develop its capitalistic tendencies the way it did over the next couple of decades?
We were definitely hoping with some conviction, and we were definitely pioneers. So the business license that we got, Foreign Investment Enterprise, was the first business license in that town. So it had a 0001 on it, which was very interesting. And I think that all the signs were there. China is open for business, open for development.
China certainly grew, it developed, and you developed right along with it. But there's certainly been a shift over the last half decade or so. You've shifted with it.
So as we grew the company, China grew at the same time extremely fast. So we went public in 2005. It was a very exciting era because it was another way of channeling capital that wanted to go into China through a route that was just starting to open up. I just remember that when we went public, we were one of the early property developers that went public. So we were a small cap. Various people from New York were phoning in, fund managers from Hong Kong as well with an international background. It was actually the start of a lot of companies going public eventually.
How long were you a public company?
So we were a public company from 2005 to 2014.
9 years?
Yes.
And then you decided to go back to private?
Yes, I think two things really. Someone made an offer to buy out our public company together with all the land bank and the projects that were in it. So it was a very good opportunity because we were able to start again in a private context and to be able to not have the quarterly pressure, basically, of doing property development.
What are your insights as to China's trajectory now? It's grown immensely. It seems to have maybe overgrown a little bit. What advice do you have to others who are looking to invest in China over the next decade or two?
I think China's very sure of how they wish to grow, and they are very sure that they have to grow into a consumer-driven, demand-driven economy rather than an investment-driven economy. They have all the tools to get there. They know that it will be a somewhat bumpy road, but I think the determination is there, and they do have the talent pool in order to get them there. What it translates into for people wanting to come and invest into China is sometimes is to filter out a lot of the noise. There's a lot that is written in the press. There's a lot of interesting stories that come out, but you have to take a long-term view. China has always been very wary of speculators coming in and speculating short-term, making lots of money, and then repatriating the funds. It is a very long-term game. It's not a game for everybody, and you need a very strong stomach in order to be able to persevere and have the patience in order to go in.
Do you have any specific advice for other people who are involved in family businesses on how they manage the family relationship and the business relationship?
I would always put family first. Family and business is very, very separate, but totally intertwined. I've seen and I've heard of a lot of other friends and examples and seen the practice in our own case that business will stay in as business, but family has to transcend and has to go beyond the business as well. So for our family side, we've always accepted that a family leader may not necessarily be the business leader, and the business leader, vice versa, will not necessarily be the family leader as well. But each is very important. It has to have its own leader. It may be the same person, but the leadership has to be there.
Well, Paul, we're ready for the rapid fire questions.
Okay.
What is your favorite question to ask when you meet someone new?
Where they're from and what line of business they're in.
Name three of your personal core values.
Integrity, working hard, and also, from an Asian perspective, respect.
Who has had the greatest impact on you as a leader?
Within my own family, my father and my uncle have been very strong leaders. And outside, I think in Asia, the leaders of China, Deng Xiaoping, bring China out, and also Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, have been very, very inspirational.
What is your favorite business book?
Henry Kissinger's World Order. Now, that may not be a business book, but I think it gave me a very interesting perspective of what's going on in the world in Asia.
What are you reading right now?
You may laugh. I'm reading Jules Verne, Around the World in 80 Days.
And a lovely movie as well.
Absolutely.
What is the one leadership trait that brings success?
Open-mindedness.
What is the one leadership trait that kills success?
Unfairness. Leaders have to be very fair, both to business partners and to staff.
Name one daily behavior that will help a leader grow.
Reading and speaking to someone that you haven't spoken to for a while and who may not be on your same wavelength.
Name one trait that makes an employee valuable.
Initiative. Employees who take initiative really stand out from the crowd.
What is your strangest daily habit?
I limit the time I spend on emails and WhatsApps.
How much do you limit it to?
I try and look at most maybe 3 times a day.
Morning, noon, and night?
Yes, sometimes compressed.
What's the best way to show employees appreciation?
I think to speak candidly with them, to ask how they are, how their family are, and to understand what makes them tick.
Well, I appreciate you sharing a little bit of what makes you tick, Paul. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Thanks for joining us today, and thanks to Gazelles Growth Institute for underwriting this program. Learn more at growthinstitute.com. Join me next week when I'll be interviewing YPO member Francis Lobo, Chief Revenue Officer at WeWork. He'll be sharing with us the difference between working to make a living and working to make a life. I'm Kevin Daum, and you're listening to the YPO 10-Minute Tips from the Top. To learn more about YPO, please visit www.ypo.org.